Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have the pleasure, like every week, to join you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. In this program, as you all know, we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse in as much detail as it is necessary. We've completed 5 chapters. We began the 6th chapter last week, and we'll continue with the 6th chapter. The chapter is about Dhyana Yoga. Probably we'll start with a short summary of what we completed last week so that it gives us a context for the shlokas that we will be going through today. The last week we, in fact, completed the summary of the chapter 5, which I started the week before that. There were a couple of verses which were left, and we spoke about that. We had discussed briefly the idea behind the 6th chapter itself. And one of the things that Krishna has conveyed through these chapters that we have covered till now is that spirituality is an internal process. Yes, there are external manifestations in the way one speaks and one leads one's life, but essentially spirituality is a very internal and personal process. So even the concept of sannyasa or renunciation is not about giving up objects or giving up duties. It is more about giving up something much, much more deeper within, giving up desires. Be it a sannyasi or a householder, it is only a choice at the end of the day. And every choice comes with duties that are related to that choice. So in that sense, a sannyasi may give up the duties towards his or her family, but there are still duties for that particular lifestyle also. So whatever is the lifestyle that has been chosen by the individual, one has to perform the duties without desires for outcomes. Anashritha karma phalam karyam karma karoti yaha. Whoever is able to perform the assigned duty without any attachment or looking forward to the karma phalam, Krishna describes that person, and he goes on to say that such a person is a sannyasi as well as a karma yogi. So there should not be dependence in the consequences when one is performing the assigned task. That assigned tasks could be that of a householder, it could be that of a monk who has chosen to stay away from society. That is all it takes to be a karma yogi and a sannyasi, right? And Krishna makes that categorically clear. Not by merely giving up rituals and responsibilities, one can either become a sannyasi or a yogi. And Krishna says, you become a true sannyasi or a karma yogi only when this shift happens inside. Necessarily, that's the point that is being made. It is not about what dress you wear, how you carry out yourself, what choices you've made in life. It's about this very essential shift in thinking that has to happen within, which is, I don't work to fulfill my desires, but I work to fulfill my duties. That should be the driving force of all actions. And we will see that again partially in today's shlokas that we go through. Why is that shift so very essential? Then in the 2nd shloka of the chapter, Krishna says, what is referred to as sannyasa, O Arjuna, know that to be karma yoga indeed. We know how Arjuna has been contemplating sannyasa. And here Krishna is telling, your idea of sannyasa is not the true one. True sannyasa is what I am telling you. What I am referring to as karma yoga is in fact true sannyasa. So true renunciation of sannyasa is indeed true karma yoga too. And one cannot become a true karma yogi or a true sannyasi for that matter without the renunciation of sankalpas. And that's what is the important point that Krishna makes in the 2nd verse of the 6th chapter. So though fundamentally if you look at the word sankalpa, it means thoughts, right? It means thoughts, it means will, it means we use it in different contexts. But the context it is being used in this particular verse is more of one's aspirations or one's desires. You know, such thoughts that eventually end up becoming ragas and divishas, and more importantly become the source of inspiration for our deeds, right? That is being referred to as sankalpa. So a karma yogi also has to renounce, a sannyasi also has to renounce, But what is to be renounced is not rituals, is not duties towards one's family. It is the renunciation of this sankalpa. Right? That's the point where we concluded. And this is a very important point that Krishna is making, a very important lesson which we will come to. And this will be the pretty much the theme of the next few shlokas before Krishna enters into speaking about meditation per se. So with that introduction, we'll go into the rest of the shlokas. We will go to shloka number 3. It's a very interesting shloka. It is interpreted in different ways. We will look at it. I'll explain to you, and we will also, I'll try to give you most of those explanations so that we can understand better how people look at it, and we will draw the best explanation or meaning that we can draw from that particular shloka, even again based on what Swami has said also. So we'll listen to shloka number 3. I'll give you a brief meaning after that, and then we will discuss in detail.
Arurukshor munir yogam karma karana muchyate yogarudhasya tasyaiva shamah karana muchyate.
For the sage who wishes to ascend to yoga, action or karma is said to be the means. For that person, when he has ascended yoga, shama alone is said to be the means. So that is the shloka which I mentioned has been interpreted in many ways. Different interpretations are given. There are a lot of disagreements regarding this particular shloka. And whenever I happen to come across shlokas like this, of course the first recourse is to look at what Swami has said and can we come up with an understanding based on that. And after that, the whole idea is to try to share that interpretation or understanding which makes sense to me, right, or which I can relate to, and that is what I try to explain. And as I always say, if any of you disagree with me, if any of you feel that there is a better explanation for this, feel free to write to me. I would definitely be happy to be informed by you listeners. But for now, since I have the mic, I'm going to give you the understanding that I can relate to. But before we get into the shloka itself, the points to be remembered here are, still Krishna has not started speaking about dhyana or meditation. Well, in our discussion, we have started speaking about it, but so far Krishna hasn't mentioned it, right? That's one thing that has to be kept in mind. And Krishna has started this chapter by saying, one who performs actions without desire for the fruits is a karma yogi and is a sannyasi too. And in the second verse, we just saw the summary, Krishna speaks about renouncing sankalpas or thoughts that eventually drive us into performing actions that lead to consequence and then eventually bind us. Swami summarizes this portion in this way in the Gita Vahini. I'll just read out those few lines. Swami says, and I quote, "Those who renounce the fruits while actively engaged in action are very dear to me. They are the true renouncers or sannyasis. I have no affection for those who give up the ritual fire and desist from all activity except eating, sleeping and craving sensory pleasures and behave like Kumbhakarna's kinsmen, idling and wasting their time. I am unapproachably far from idlers. One who has not renounced the pursuit of wishes can never become a yogi, however busy they may be in spiritual disciplines. Only one who is careful not to get entangled in the senses and who is unattached to the consequence of deeds can become a renouncer of all attachments." End of quote. So the point is, very clearly, there is a reiteration that giving up action is not being spoken of at all. That is not being presented as an option at all. There is a mention of a state where the senses are controlled, right? This may be a reference to dhyana, but it is still not a directly, still not Krishna or even Swami speaking directly about meditation. Now when we come to this shloka, Krishna uses a few words which are not very clearly explained within the shloka itself, and that is one of the causes for the confusion. Krishna begins by saying, Arurukshoho munehe. Arurukshu. Aruhu means to ascend a peak or ascend a mountain. So Aruhu means to ascend. So Arurukshu means one who wishes to ascend. Just like Mumukshu is one who wishes to attain mukti. Arurukshu is one who wishes to Aruhu or ascend. Arurukshoho munehe means the sage or aspirant who is desirous of ascending. Well, the problem comes with the next word. Ascending where or ascending what? Krishna says, Arurukshoho munehe yogam. The sage who wishes to ascend to yoga. Karma karanam uchyate. It is said that karma is the karana or means for this expedition of trying to ascend yoga. We'll complete the meaning of the shloka and then come back to the portions which cause confusion. Krishna goes on to say, Yoga rudhasya, for one who has attained yoga or is absorbed in yoga. Yoga rudha is one who is absorbed in yoga. Tasyaiva, for such a person only, shamaha karanam uchyate. It is said that shama is the means. Shama is a state of withdrawal or equipoise. Now, according to some commentators, when Krishna says, for one who wishes to reach yoga, when Krishna says, arurukshoho munehe yogam, karma is the means, right? That's what he says in that first line. The word yoga, some commentators interpret it as standing for dhyana yoga. So it means that the one who wishes to ascend the peak of dhyana yoga, karma is the means. That would be the interpretation if you look at it that way. Now, till now we have seen whenever Krishna says yoga, it was always a reference to karma yoga, right? We heard him saying, this is what a yogi does, this is what a sankhya does, or when he says the path of yoga, the reference was always clearly to karma yoga. And as I mentioned some time back, Krishna per se has not started speaking about dhyana directly at all. So how is the reference being made to dhyana in this particular statement where Krishna is saying only yoga? The word in the second line, yoga rudha, which means the one who has achieved yoga, that is the one which causes the confusion, because the word yoga rudha is also used for a person who is absorbed in deep meditation. So based on that usage, some commentators say that the first line is also making a reference to ascending the peak of dhyana yoga. So one of the interpretations of this shloka is, karma is the means for one who wants to attain dhyana yoga. And for one who has reached that state of meditation, inaction is the means. Where the second line, clearly says the one who is a yoga rudha, one who has already attained that, shama is the karana, shama is the means. So he says, for one who wants to ascend the peak, karma is the means of getting there. So one who has already reached the peak, shama is the means, which means once you have reached the peak of yoga, you don't have to perform actions, right? So this interpretation suggests that karma is necessary till a certain point, but thereafter karma too has to be renounced. Now the problem with this interpretation is how it is very conveniently used to justify sannyasa. So let us say that I am a sannyasi and I am quoting the shloka. And when I'm a sannyasi, I try to defend my position. I try to defend my choice. So how will I explain this particular shloka then? When I say, if I am a sannyasi, I mean someone who has taken to that path. And
in my narrowness, I'm trying to justify my choice, right? I'm not talking about a true sannyasi. I'm not talking about a truly noble soul who has become a sannyasi. Let me make that very clear. So when I say I am a sannyasi, I'm talking about me being a narrow-minded person who has taken to the path of sannyasa and is trying to defend my choice, right? Let me put it that way.
So if I am a sannyasi who is trying to justify my choice in life, I will quote this particular shloka with this interpretation that I have just given and say, so look, karma yoga is important, but it is important because it leads to meditation. But still karma is like a lower standard or lower class. Because one who is a master of meditation like me, then I can renounce actions altogether. Right? That would be the way I would interpret this to justify myself. But this interpretation is achieved by stretching the meaning of some of the words, as we've already seen, and extrapolating the context itself. When Krishna says yoga, I make it into dhyana yoga or meditation, which, as I said, has not been spoken about till now. Then I interpret shama as renunciation of activity, whereas truly speaking, shama is only withdrawing the senses and maintaining an equipoise, not necessarily giving up actions in that sense. And given that just in the first verse of this chapter that we have gone through, Krishna had said, only giving up of desires for fruits of actions is yoga and sannyasa. Na niragnihi cha akriyaha. Not the act of giving up rituals or duties. So clearly Krishna cannot be speaking about giving up actions altogether just two shlokas later, right? So that is why this interpretation probably is not the right way to look at it. But this idea is not completely meaningless, because what is said in this interpretation is also partially right, and that's why I thought I should put it forth. In fact, Swami puts it this way in Gita Vahini, and I quote, and you will see that there is a similarity between this interpretation and what Swami says. The yoga of meditation, I'm quoting Swami now, the yoga of meditation is possible only on the basis of this renunciation of the fruit of action. If the mind is not under control and amenable to one's orders, it can become one's greatest foe. So, live in solitude so that you can master the senses. A horse without reins, a bull unused to the yoke, and a spiritual aspirant whose senses are not mastered, are all like a river without water. Such spiritual discipline is a waste. End of quote. So what Swami is saying here is very clear. If dhyana yoga is the peak that one wishes to scale, if you want to attain jnana through meditation, right? That's what we refer to as dhyana yoga, the path of yoga, it's the path of meditation itself. Even for that, mastery of senses is necessary. If the senses and the mind are out of control, you just cannot meditate, isn't it? Imagine this time of lockdown, we're all in our homes, we're all working from our homes, we've been advised not to leave homes unless it is necessary. To keep our own company is not easy, isn't it? It needs a certain amount of self-control, it needs a certain amount of mental balance. Sitting in meditation is you literally locking yourself up in the body, right? If I'm going to sit in one place and meditate, it is like a lockdown of myself into my body. How much more mind and sense control is required for that? And Swami says that in this particular portion that I read out, that control comes only from karma yoga. So that part of the interpretation that says that karma is the means for one who wants to reach the peak of dhyana is somewhat valid, right? That for meditation, karma yoga becomes a means. Then what will be the interpretation of the next line? Yoga rudhasya tasya iva shamah karanam uchyate. Yoga rudhasya, as I said, is one who is already in the state of yoga. Tasya iva karanam means, what is the means to maintain that yoga rudha state? Right? I've reached the peak. What does it take for me to remain there? I've taken to the path. Now how can I maintain it?
through shama or self-restraint. So this is similar to what we were discussing last week, where meditation is a tool to maintain that state of being a spiritual person in the world. We need to draw ourselves, our mind, we need to draw ourselves within. We have to draw our mind within from world every now and then. I think during one of the answering booth sessions, I've spoken about this, and I've spoken about it as a process of recalibration that we need to do every now and then. A karma yogi has to use the mind to do a worldly activity to attain the spiritual goal, right? That's the definition of a karma yogi. He's in the world, he's using his mind to do worldly tasks, but the goal is spiritual. So every now and then, the karma yogi needs to draw the mind within and perform this act of recalibration. Ensure that the karma yogi doesn't lose the focus, right? Because every time when you go into the world gives you different targets, the world gives you different goals to go after. So one needs to draw oneself within and recalibrate one's purpose in taking up action. Before we move on to the next shloka, there is another very beautiful interpretation for the shloka, and I thought I will share that also. And as I said, this is one of the interpretations that I'm able to relate to. It's very beautiful and very simple. And when I say interpretation, it is not simply force-fitting an idea, right? It is not somebody who has just read the shloka and said that, oh, this is the interpretation I would like to give. This interpretation is also based on the grammar of the shloka. It is based on the context of where it is being said in the Gita. It is also based on the study of the words which are being used, because certain words are used in a certain context. As I said, whenever Krishna said yoga, it meant karma yoga. So keeping all of that in mind, this is a interpretation which is given. In the first line, it is said, yogam karma karana muchyate. When we say karana, it is translated as cause or means, right? The question is, means for what, right? That's where the problem is. The word yogam is given as the karya, right? Karanam and karya, that's how it is said. These are the two things. Karanam is the means, karya is that which has to be achieved. So here the karanam is karma, the karya is yogam, right? I hope that is clear. So the interpretation is, to reach the state of yoga or a spiritual life, right? Yoga eventually is union with God. So yoga literally means leading a spiritual life with spiritual goals, aligning oneself to all the spiritual ideas and spiritual disciplines, right? So the interpretation here is, to reach the state of yoga or to live a spiritual life, it is, in this sense, we are talking about, when we say yoga, we are talking about karma yoga, right? So when we say to reach a state of yoga, to reach a state of being a karma yogi. So for a life of karma yoga, to scale this peak and become a karma yogi, karma is the means. As we had discussed in the third chapter, we must have a certain kind of reverence towards the karma that we perform, because without karma, there cannot be any karma yoga. Without my duties, I cannot offer anything to God. I am somebody's son, I am somebody's daughter, I am somebody's father, I am somebody's mother. That role gives me an opportunity to perform karma, and that karma I can offer it to God and make it karma yoga. So karma itself is the means for karma yoga. So when Krishna says here in this first statement, yogam karma karanam uchyate, it means that for becoming a karma yogi, karma is the means. In the next line, Krishna says, shamaha karanam. Shama or equipoise is the means. But means for what? It is said means for karma. Let me try to rephrase that. Arurukshoho munehe is a sadhaka who wants to ascend the peak of being in yoga. Now to reach that peak, karma is used as a means. The aspirant needs karma in that sense to reach that peak. Now once he or she has reached there, one becomes a yoga rudha who has accomplished that state of yoga. Now this person also continues to perform actions.
as Krishna has been saying since the second chapter, even the perfected ones continue to perform actions. So what is the means of actions for such a person? The actions are performed as a result of tranquility or equipoise, as a result of shama. So till I become a jnani, I use karma as a means for knowledge. But after I become a jnani, the jnana or the peace that is associated with that state of jnana becomes the means of all my actions. I hope that statement makes sense. I'll repeat that again so you can grasp it. Till I become a jnani, I use karma as a means for knowledge. But after I become a jnani, the jnana or the peace of that state of being a jnani, that state becomes the means or the source of all my actions. Because in that state there are no more desires, not even spiritual desires, right? So that is another beautiful way of interpreting this particular shloka. I mentioned both because both have a relevance to us. One speaks of the importance of karma yoga for meditation and meditation for karma yoga. And the other speaks of how the source of motivation for karma changes. And these we can see even in our everyday life, right? Even as we are progressing on the path, the more spiritual we become, we will not reduce our actions, but our actions will be born of desirelessness, maybe born out of self-satisfaction and born out of inner peace, right? That is what is being told here. So just to quickly tell that again, like now I want to become a karma yogi, right? Let's say I've just become a sadhaka, I've just been introduced to spirituality, I want to become a karma yogi. Now what do? I start performing karmas as a means of reaching that state of karma yoga. So I still have desires. It's not like the desires have gone away, but I've sublimated the desires. I've kind of replaced the desires. I'm using the actions to reach the state of a karma yogi. And let us say I've become a karma yogi. Whatever actions I perform, I do it with that perfection, without having attachment to the desires. So now, how will I be performing my actions? I will be performing my actions from a deep sense of peace and inner tranquility. Right? That's one of the interpretation. It makes a lot of sense. And as we've been seeing in the third chapter, in the fourth chapter, we can see that shift happening even in the path as we are going through. More and more actions will be done very selflessly without having any craving for applause or accolades. Whether somebody sees or not, we will be doing things perfectly. That change will happen and it will be perceivable. Not for anybody else, maybe for others also, but definitely for ourselves if we are sincere enough. Right? So that is the third shloka, which I said has got different interpretations. We'll go to the next shloka and I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss that in detail.
Yada hinendriyartheshu na karmasvanushajjate sarva sankalpa sanyasi yogarudhastadochyate.
When a person indulges himself neither in what is desired by the senses nor in the actions for it, then alone, being a man of renouncing all intentions, he is said to have mounted on the yoga. So in this verse, Krishna connects what he has been saying in the past three verses. In the first verse, he said, the sannyasa of sankalpa is necessary, right? Or renunciation of the thought or of desire that drive one to action is necessary. And in the previous verse, we spoke of yoga rodha. In this verse, Krishna states, sarva sankalpa sannyasi yoga rodha tadochyate. A person who is a sarva sankalpa sannyasi, a renouncer of all sankalpas, he is spoken of as a yoga rodha, one who has attained the peak of yoga. But how does one reach that state? That Krishna mentions in the first line. Yadahi, when indeed, na indriya arteshu, not in sense objects, na karmasu, not in actions, anushajjate, is attached or cling. Anushajjate means to be attached or to cling to something. So one who is not attached to indriya arteshu, sense objects, karmasu, to actions, he is referred to as a yoga rudha. This word is quite similar to this particular word which Krishna uses here for attachment. Anushajjate is very similar to what Krishna had said, I think way back in the second chapter, in trying to describe a jnani. He had said, Yaha sarvatra anabhisneha. We had seen the meaning of this word, abhisneha. Abhisneha means getting stuck to something. You know, it's literally being sticky towards something. That's the literal meaning of sneha. So abhisneha means getting stuck to something. Similarly, the word anushajjate being used here is getting stuck to it, right? So the constant description of a spiritual person is not one who is completely running away from the world, but is able to be in the world without being attached to it, without clinging on to it. Krishna mentions that again in the shloka. He says, na indriya arteshu. The person uses the objects of the world, so sense objects, but never gets attached to it. Similarly, na karmasu. One performs actions, but is never stuck to those karmas. How does one get stuck to karmas in the first place? With the idea that I have done these actions so well, now I want to be rewarded for it. I want to be recognized for it, right? With the doership, automatically comes the idea of enjoyership, kartritva and bhuktritva. And when bhuktritva is there, you are making yourself susceptible to kama and krodha. And when there is kama and krodha, you have a whole list of things that come onto you, and Krishna says that you'll be bound, you'll be further illusioned, right? So that's how one gets bound to karmas. So when Krishna says, yadahi na indriya arteshu na karmas vanushajjate, it clearly means not one who gives up this world with sense objects and karmas, but not being bound or attached to them. Going back to the previous verse, even a karma yogi has some form of desires behind the karma that is being performed, right? That's what I made a brief mention about when I was talking about the previous shloka. As we have discussed even earlier in the series, in the karma yogi, the desire for success, the desire for glory, the desire for money, and these things are replaced with mumukshatva, or the desire for liberation, right? Because the person still has aspirations, or more than saying the person has aspirations, the person has the quality of having aspirations. A jnani is a person who has reached a state where he no more can come down to a state of having desires, right? He's completely insulated from the world or samsara in that sense. But whereas when you're talking about a karma yogi, when you're talking about a sadhaka, he's still capable of having those aspirations. So what does a karma yogi do? He replaces lower aspirations with the aspiration for liberation. Mukshatva is introduced. But still there is a motive for karma, right? Mumukshatva becomes the motive for karma in the case of a karma yogi. But when one becomes a yoga rudha, there is no desire backing the actions. It is not that there are no karmas, but the feeling that I have to do this to achieve this. I have to do this because this is my duty. I have to do this, otherwise people will think otherwise about me. There are no such sankalpas behind the actions of one who has scaled this peak. Actions arise from shama, as Krishna mentioned in the previous verse. Actions arise from the tranquility of complete withdrawal, a sense of equipoise that is born out of completeness, right? There is nothing for me to achieve. When I don't have anything to achieve, I am satisfied.
when I don't have anything to achieve, my actions can be born out of a state of calmness or completeness. So where does dhyana come into all of this? Of course, Krishna has still not mentioned it directly, other than a few shlokas in the previous chapter where he gave a hint. But he's clearly laying the foundation by saying how it is important to act from the state of tranquility. In the case of a jnani, there is jnana, and there is the peace that is born out of that jnana, right? That paramashanti, as Krishna has been saying, or supreme peace, which is born out of jnana, which is like it tags along with self-knowledge. But for us, or for a regular sadhaka, we can't call ourselves muni yet, right? Krishna uses the word, he says, aru ruksho ho munehe. We probably cannot call ourselves munihi, but we have, you know, we probably will fall into the idea of aru ruksho ho yogam, that we are aspirants who are trying to scale this life of yoga, the desire to ascend the peak of yoga. So what becomes a natural state for one who has reached the pinnacle becomes a means for one who is wanting to ascend. So for us, the moments of tranquility become a tool, and that is what is meditation, right? And that's what I had spoken about even in the introduction to the sixth chapter. These are all moments of times when we withdraw, when we recalibrate, when we draw ourselves from the world. Because a karma yogi has to go into the world. It is, as Swami would say, it is like the lotus that has to live in the slush. The lotus has to find some means by which it is not affected by the slush. And biologically, the lotus has a different layer on its leaf, and that's how it does it. So when it comes to a karma yogi, one has to find ways by which every now and then we are able to completely withdraw from the world and find that tranquility within and operate from that, right? That is where meditation comes in. As I just said, Krishna has not spoken about it completely or openly as yet. We'll come to it when it comes to it. In fact, I don't think it's coming in the next 3 or 4 shlokas as yet. But we will go back to what Krishna is saying in this particular portion of the 6th chapter. We'll go to the next verse. The next few verses are very interesting. They are very fundamental. They give us a very fundamental understanding and an instruction about the spiritual path. I found the next 2 shlokas very interesting, the way they are worded, the concepts they are conveying. It's very simple. It's not that it's going to tell something that we don't know or we have not heard from Swami, but the way it has been put is very beautiful. We'll listen to it. This is shloka number 5. Again, we'll listen to it in the voice of Brother Shyam, and then we'll discuss about it after that.
उद्धरेदात्मनात्मानम् नात्मानमवसादयेत् आत्मैव ह्यात्मनो बन्धुः आत्मैवरिपुरात्मनः.
One should save oneself by oneself. One should not lower oneself. For oneself is verily one's own friend. Oneself is verily one's own enemy. So this is a very beautiful shloka that gives us this very important message about the spiritual path itself. As we go through life, the environment around us, our upbringing, the people whom we encounter in life, they all play a very important role in our life, right? Nobody can refute that fact. If we were born in a certain family, a certain type of a family, we may be well educated, we may be brought up with certain values. Similarly, when we talk about our career, you know, many times we find that we meet the right kind of people at the right time who help us grow. At the end of life, if you have not achieved much, you can probably say that, you know, I didn't get the right kind of support from my parents. I didn't get the right kind of upbringing. My friends cheated me, or, you know, I started a business and these business partners were incompetent, and because of that, I couldn't achieve how much I could have achieved otherwise. But all of these we can speak only with regards to the worldly success or the worldly progress that we see. In spirituality, in the spiritual journey, you cannot blame anyone at all. You have to take complete responsibility for where you are at this moment with regards to our spiritual journey. And that is the greatest boon of spiritual path, as well as who doesn't like a state where you can't blame anybody, right? We all want somebody to blame. And if something goes wrong, we want to point at somebody and say that this is the reason it didn't go wrong. So it is a luxury, right? Really speaking, when you work in a team, in a family, when you're able to put the blame on somebody, it's a luxury. In the spiritual path, you don't have that luxury. You cannot claim that luxury. It is the greatest boon because you don't need anything else, right? When you say the spiritual journey does not need a friend, does not need a good upbringing, does not need anything outside, it is empowering because you don't need anything to reach the spiritual goal. But the luxury of putting the blame on somebody else or holding somebody else responsible for your failures, that luxury is not available in the spiritual path. Why is it the greatest boon? Because you can be anyone. You could be rich, you could be poor, you could be a minister, you could be a commoner, you could be a devotee, you could be anything. You could be able-bodied, you could be differently abled. It really doesn't matter. You can still take to the path of yoga. You can still reach the peak. You can still redeem yourself. And this is the thought that would many, many times occur to me when I was sitting in Mandir, when Swami would be giving darshan, when Swami would be interacting with devotees. There are some who would get Swami's attention. There are many who would not get it. It may look like Swami is speaking to some students. It looks like Swami is ignoring some students. You know, there's possibly a minister or a rich man who is sitting in the portico or a veranda, and it looks like Swami is speaking to him. You probably might see a poor man who is sitting from 4 in the morning, but Swami doesn't talk to him. But of course, let me make it very clear that if you sit long enough in the mandir and if you observe Swami long enough, you will realize that there is no pattern to how Swami blesses an individual and speaks to somebody and does not speak to someone. Right? It's a completely divine mathematics that you and I will not understand. But when we observe Swami for a very brief time, right? We have observed Swami for 10 years, and even that is a very, very brief time to observe Swami and come to conclusions, right? So when you see Swami for a brief time, you look at all of this and you say that, Swami is being favorable towards someone, or Swami is ignoring someone. But it does appear that way, right? Swami doesn't give grace equally to everyone. That is a sense that you get. Then how can Swami's love and grace be equal to everyone? It is then that occurred to me that, the greatest blessings that Swami can give are all spiritual. And what is spiritual is never dependent on anything that is physical, even if it is the Lord himself who has come in the physical form. Every individual sitting in the hall, in the Kulwant hall, in the Ramesh hall, or wherever in Swami's presence, has the equal ability to receive that grace from Swami. Right? Whether Swami speaks to a person, whether Swami doesn't speak to a person, whether Swami speaks lovingly, whether Swami speaks sternly, all of that doesn't matter at all. Every single individual had the absolute equal approach to Swami's grace, or the claim to Swami's grace. Swami was equally showering his grace on everyone, but we were accepting or rejecting it based on our own thoughts and ideas. The filter was in us. It was never outside, right? So when you look at it from Swami's point of view, Swami was equally beneficent towards everyone. That's why he's called Suhrit Sarvabhutanam, right? That's one of the beautiful descriptions we saw in the end of the 5th chapter. He is a benefactor to everyone without any discrimination. You're a devotee of Swami, you're not a devotee of Swami, you're a good person, you're a bad person. Let me say even that. Swami's grace is equal towards everyone. But it is our mind which says that this much grace is enough for me, or no, I want more, right? That is there only in the mind. That filter is there only in the mind. So in the spiritual path, we alone are responsible for our redemption, and we alone are responsible for our failures. For a karma yogi,
even the worst situation is a means for spiritual progress, isn't it? I face a disaster today, I face a failure, or I see an enormous success and profit in my business. If I am a karma yogi, if I am a sadhaka, if I am a mumukshu, if I am an arurukshu, then it all becomes only an opportunity to progress on the spiritual journey, isn't it? So in that sense, when we turn to spirituality, we lose the freedom to complain, because you cannot complain on anyone, because you yourself are responsible for every progress that you've made or failure that you have faced. What is there to complain? Because everything becomes a tool to progress if you have the right attitude. You could have the worst disaster facing your life, but if you're a spiritual aspirant, that becomes an opportunity. Right? When Krishna says, Sukha Dukhe Same Kritva Labha Labho Jaya Jayo, that, you know, you should treat Sukha and Dukha as same, you should treat Labha and Alabha, or profit and loss as same. I must be able to treat sorrow and happiness same. How will I get to that state if I am not given sorrow and failure to practice that equanimity? So if I am truly a spiritual person, when such disasters happen, I will not have a reason to complain, because I know that that is part of this training and I should be grateful for that. So there is a complete shift in approach that has to take place in the mentality itself. And this, that no one can do it for us, right? This shift in mentality, this becoming a worldly person, becoming a karma yogi, a person who is an aspirant in the world, becoming an aspirant in the spiritual path, this shift cannot be made by anybody else. That has to be made by the individual. And this shloka is a very powerful reminder of that. And Krishna says it, puts it this way, he says, Atmana, by the self, Atmanam, the self, Uddharet, should raise. Atmanam, the self, Na Avasadayet, should not be let down or pulled down, Atma, by oneself. So one must raise oneself, one must not pull down oneself. We have seen this a few times already, right? The word Atma is used with multiple meanings. One of the meanings of Atma is that supreme Atman, the pure soul. Atma is also used sometimes to refer to the mind. And Atma is also referred to simply mean self, myself or yourself, right? So in this shloka, it is used in the idea of oneself. I must raise myself. I must not put down myself. Then Krishna goes on to say, Atmaivahi Atmano Bandhu. Very beautiful words. Atmaivahi Atmano Bandhu. The self is the self's own friend. Atmaiva Ripuratmanaha. The self alone is the self's enemy. So clearly the self is not the Atma, because the Atma is pure and it cannot be anybody's enemy. The Atma being referred to here, the word Atma is used for oneself. So you are your own friend. You are your own enemy. I think this is a very important thought to keep in the mind. In the spiritual path, you are forfeiting your right to complain, your right to blame somebody else, your right to say that, oh, my parents did not teach me, my teachers did not teach me, oh, my friends disillusioned me, or I lost my way because I had bad company. No. If you are taking a step forward, you are the reason for that. If you have slipped one step, you are the reason for that. And this is not in the sense of blaming oneself, right? This is in the sense of taking responsibility for one's own life. There's a huge difference between blaming and being responsible. Even when you're saying it, we know that one is negative, used in a negative connotation, and one is used in a very positive and empowering connotation. So we take responsibility for ourselves, and that's what the shloka is all about. Of course, this can of course be seen in the absolute philosophical sense too. The friend is also the Atma, the foe is also the Atma, there is no two, there is always one. You know, one who helps you is also the pure self, the one who harms you is also the pure self. That's probably a very philosophical way of looking at this shloka. Though that idea is not wrong per se, I don't think that is the idea being conveyed in this particular shloka, because we will see that in the following shlokas, how Krishna literally opens up the shloka for us and explains it in the next two shlokas. Because till now Krishna was saying about how a sannyasi and a karma yogi are one and the same, because the renunciation that must be done is that of the sankalpas. My mind, the thoughts or the aspirations, the drive in my mind has to be renounced. Now who can make me do that? Who can make me give up my sankalpas? Swami himself would say, you know, I will only teach you, to learn is up to you. Swami would often give this analogy, the mother will serve the food on the plate. Maybe if you're too young, the mother might even feed the food with her own hands. But the chewing and the digestion cannot be done by the mother, how much ever she loves you. And Swami would say, in the same manner, I can only teach you, I can teach you repeatedly, I can teach you with infinite love. But the learning has to be done by you, the absorption of the message has to be done by you. Right? So in the spiritual journey, one must take the responsibility to lift up oneself. You are your own friend. And Swami's definition of a friend is very, very clear. He or she who takes you closer to God is a friend. The one who takes you away from God is an enemy. So when Krishna says here, Atmaivahi Atmano Bandhu, the self is one's own companion or self is one's own friend, it means you alone can take yourself to God. Atmaiva Ripuratmanaha, you alone can take you away from God. Right? And that is the very important message that Krishna is giving in the shloka, that stand up and take responsibility for your life. If you want to change, you have to change. Nobody can change you. If you want to lead a spiritual life, you have to choose. You have to hold on to it. And you, if you slip, you have to pick yourself and you have to walk. And that is what is being said here, right? Sometime back, I think maybe in the initial few episodes, I had spoken about this beautiful inner significance of Krishna being the charioteer. Right, there is this analogy that we always refer to from the Kathopanishad, where the mind is referred, the mind and the inner instrumentalities, the antakarnas, are equated to the scenario of a charioteer driving a chariot. To quickly refresh, where we say the horses are the senses, the reins is the manas, or the working mind. The person who is driving the chariot is the buddhi or the intellect, and the person who is traveling in the chariot is the jivatma, right? And the analogy goes that if the senses, the whole chariot itself is the body, by the way. If the senses are going to drag you, if the senses are very powerful, the horses are wild, they're very powerful, they will pull the reins. The person who's holding the reins will not have any control. So the chariot will go anywhere it wants to go. There is no purpose in the direction the chariot takes. But on the other hand, if the person who's the charioteer, the buddhi, if the buddhi is able to take control of the chariot, then the buddhi will be able to take the chariot, taking command from the conscience where it needs to go. So what is the whole idea of Krishna becoming the charioteer for Arjuna? The beautiful explanation or interpretation of that is, when I go to a guru, when I go to Swami, when Swami gives me a message, when I try to live my life based on that message, whatever that message could be, Swami would say love all, serve all, or Swami would say that, you know, always be good to everyone, always speak obligingly, whatever it is, Swami has given me a message. Now I make that message my buddhi, right? Literally I take the guru's words, and the guru's words now become my charioteer. The guru's words become those that will drive my actions, drive my senses, drive my body. So when we say that Krishna sat on the place of the charioteer and took up the role of a charioteer, it is referring to this. The guru's words, the guru's message must themselves become the buddhi. They must become the charioteer of this body, right? That's the whole idea. So in that sense, you could have, you know, as a guru, Swami stands in front of you, as a loving mother is there, or you have your parents who have given you beautiful guidance, who have given you the values that is required to lead you through this life. But having received all of that, finally you have to make those words your charioteer, right? You have to make those words a part of you, and then you have to raise yourself.
You could have, I mean, what more example can I give you? You have the Lord himself come in a human form and standing in front of you, and Swami says, look, I cannot do anything. I can only give you the direction, whether you follow it or not, whether you lift yourself or not is completely up to you. Swami himself is saying that, right? So who can change our life? You could have the best parents, you could go to the best schools, you could have the best company among your friends. But if you have not internalized that goodness and you have not lifted yourself, you will not be good. In the same manner, you could be in the worst environment. You could be brought up in the wrong way. You could have been told the wrong things. You've been indoctrinated in the wrong way. But if you have chosen not to make that a part of your being, if you have chosen not to make that a part of the way you discriminate and make choices, then you have not become your own enemy, right? So that's the whole point that Krishna is making here. And it's a very important point, as I said. I think what I'll do is I will just play the next shloka to give you an idea of what Krishna is saying here, especially that second statement that he made, that you are your own friend, you are your own enemy. He's going to expand that in the next shloka and the shloka thereafter. So before we conclude, I'll probably just play that shloka for you. I will just read out the meaning so that you can think over it. But the detailed study of that shloka we'll do only next week. So this is the sixth shloka of the sixth chapter. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And with that, we'll conclude this week's episode.
Bandhuratmatmanastasya yenatmaivatmanajitah anatmanastu shatrutve vartetatmaiva shatruvat.
The self is the friend of the self of him by whom the self has been conquered by the self. But to the unconquered self, this self stands in the position of an enemy, like an external foe. So that's the meaning of the sixth verse. I know probably it did not convey much, but I will just let you with that, and I'll let you think about that. It's a very beautiful idea. You are saying that you don't have a friend or foe outside. The friend and the foe is within. But what is that situation inside which becomes friendly? What is that situation inside that becomes unfriendly is what Krishna mentioned in that sixth verse. The next week, I'll again play this verse again. I'll again give you the meaning and we'll talk about it. I thought we'll just leave with that. So we will conclude this week's episode with this, dear listeners. Thank you for joining me. We'll continue with this sixth chapter in the next Thursday live, 7:30 p.m. as always. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and I thank each one of you for your patient listening. In a short while from now, I'll be playing for you a talk Brother Bishu has given. This was a talk that he had the opportunity to deliver online. Now, most of the satsangs all through the world are happening online, and this is one of the sessions that Bishu had the opportunity to do. I think this was a session that he had done a short while ago. I think 26th of March is the date he has given. On 26th of March, he had the opportunity to interact with devotees in Sri Lanka over an online talk. I think that's the talk I'm going to play for you. The talk also incorporates a few questions that he took at the end of it. So even that is there. I hope you'll enjoy it. You'll find it enlightening and enjoyable. Any feedback that you wish to give for this talk, for the programs that you've heard so far, feel free to write to us. You can write to our feedback mail, listener@radiosci.org. If you have any specific feedback to give to me or Bishu or any of the RJs, you can write to them directly. Over now to Brother Bishu for the Vahini Satsang of today, which happens to be a talk that he had delivered. Till I meet you all next week at 7:30 p.m. Take care. Jai Sai Ram.